From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater, an hour of sounds from radio's golden age, coming to you from New York's Finger Lakes region. I'm Jake Longwell. We'll open today's program with an episode of Showcase. Over the years, there have been many attempts by U.S. radio and television stations to introduce American audiences to British radio and television programming. Growing up in the 1980s and 90s, I have fond memories of having been introduced to various BBC programs on PBS, on TV, and the BBC World Service by way of public radio. Well, in the 1950s, NBC attempted something similar, and in the spring of 1954, NBC Radio launched a series called Showcase. These were test programs of sorts. Each week, Showcase featured a different BBC broadcast. The objective? To determine if there was enough of a demand for British programming by American audiences to incorporate it into the regular NBC radio schedule, or perhaps that should be schedule. This broadcast originally aired on NBC April 24th of 1954, and here they present an example of the popular BBC variety show, Take It From Here.
The National Broadcasting Company invites you to Showcase. NBC, in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, brings you another in its transcribed series of half-hour programs titled Showcase. Each week at this time, you will be entertained with one of Great Britain's top-rated programs. Near the end of our broadcast, we will ask for your critical reaction to today's offering. And now we will hear one of England's most popular variety programs, Take It From Here.
Take it from here, don't go away when you can take it from here. Why don't you stay and maybe join in the fun now, the show has begun. Half an hour of laughter beckons, every minute packed with seconds.
For the next 30 minutes, it's Take It From Here with Joy Nichols, Dick Bentley and Jimmy Edwards. Other words and music will be heard from Wallace Eaton, Herbert Mostyn and the Keynotes. And we have the augmented BBC Variety Orchestra conducted by Paul Fennelly. So if you're receiving us loud and clear, sale by auction. At Messrs. Northerby's on Thursday, at the direction of Mr. Richard Makepeace Bentley, will be auctioned an exquisite collection of rare stamps. The stamps can be purchased en bloc or separately at ninepence a thousand.
Well, Jimmy, there you are. If Dick can do it, you can too. Why don't you start a collection?
Well, I don't fancy taking the box round this audience. Oh, dear. Look at them.
No, my stamp collection.
Oh.
Why don't you go along to the auction and put in a bid?
Oh, not likely. Do you know, the last auction I went to, I just happened to clear my throat, and the next thing I knew, I was the owner of a well-worn walnut whatnot. Besides, I don't see anything in this collection business.
It's a wonderful hobby. Everybody collects something.
Oh, yes?
Edward G. Robinson collects painting. George Sanders collects first edition. James Mason collects cats. Then there's Errol Flynn.
Yes, but it becomes a sort of a mania. Do you know, I know a girl who collects ivory. She tried to marry Terry Thomas for his teeth.
Oh. Yes, Dick, what is it about collecting? What's the big appeal in just hoarding things?
Well, it's absorbing. Oh, when I think of the happy hours I've spent, my dog at my side, sticking thousands of stamps per evening.
But what does it leave you with, Dick?
An empty stamp packet and a spaniel with a dry tongue. I had a wonderful collection.
Really?
Thousands. I gave away most of my British Empire.
Well, that's fashionable anyway. But are these stamps worth anything?
Oh, they can be. For example, if you've got an unperforated triangular Zanzibar, you're worth a fortune.
Oh, I'd rather have my health.
Well, tell me, why are you selling your stamps now, Dick?
Well, for the last couple of years, I've been collecting something else.
Dust?
What I'm collecting is objet d'art.
Oh.
Antique furniture, mainly. I'm concentrating on Louis Carthorse.
Louis XIV.
Him as well. Oh, Oh, there's a wonderful aesthetic appreciation in the craftsmanship of that era, which I find infinitely satisfying. I think I should have been born in the 18th century.
It was a near miss, Benjamin. But where are you getting the money to buy all this expensive furniture?
Well, from the sale of my stamps. Oh, I had a stroke of luck. A bloke sold me a whole set of unused North Hebridean Islands, only a quid each.
North Hebridean Islands? There isn't such a stamp.
There is, you know, Joy. Look, here's one.
Show.
Yeah? Oh, yes. See? It's got a little blue and red shield and NHI on top. Now, what do you think I should get for them?
About 18 months.
18 months?
Yes, those are National Health Insurance stamps.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a unique opportunity of seeing our welfare state in operation. There goes old Mrs. Jones to collect her widow's pension of 32 and 6, followed by Frau Thyssen and her daughter to collect their 26 million quid. Passing to the Japanese section.
Well, it's Wall. Say, Wall, how's this building's Coronation Night street party getting on?
Oh, what a job, Jim. Ooh. Everything's got to be organised, right down to the last spoonful of bicarbonate. We're going to have a decorated fertilizer barge floating up and down a canal, like a pleasure boat.
Yes, I suppose it will be.
Your mum was supposed to launch it, and we couldn't make her let go of the bottle.
What are you going to decorate the barge with, Wal?
Well, we did knock off 4 dozen of them little triangular flags. Some dishonest person pinched them.
Got any idea who did it?
Oh, I'm not saying. All I know is when Mrs. Wilson's baby bends over, it don't half look colourful.
Wallace, on this fertiliser barge, what are the amenities?
Oh, well, we got dancing on the after deck, waltzes, tangos, valetas, and your dad, Jim, will be demonstrating his new step, the exercise yard shuffle. For the young people, there's be swimming. They'll be able to dive off the side.
How high is the deck from the water, Wall?
Now, that depends on how the pumps are working. But for the older people, there'll be the building's version of the popular television game, Down You Go.
What's that?
We sew lead weights in the landlord's swimming trousers. And at midnight, we have a spit on the captain's bridge.
Mutiny?
No. A spit for roasting.
Oh, a spit for roasting. Yeah.
Instead of roasting an ox, we're going one better.
Oh.
We're going to roast our old African water buffalo.
How on earth did you get hold of an African water buffalo?
It's a long story. It started when Mr. George Cansdale was having a wash and brush up at Paddington Station. He hung his jacket with the keys in on a hook, just as Jim's brother come in.
Oh,
very well then. But it'll be a night of up Britain, long live freedom, and hush, hush, whisper who dares. Edith and Bessie are sleeping upstairs.
And now for Type's topic for the week.
Type's topic. We read... Forward, Mr. Oh, no, we're doing it today.
Yes.
We read a bit in the paper last Monday about a quiz program on American radio which hit on a new idea. For first prize, the contestant won the announcer.
Yes, it's quite true. The winner got him for a week. The announcer had to go and stay at his house. So we thought, suppose the BBC tried the same stunt. Suppose a listener got awarded a BBC announcer.
Oh, hello, Mr. Dunhill. If you'd slip your Mac off.
Oh, thank you. Thank
come
you.
Through yes, to the living room. I've got some friends waiting who are dying to meet you. Well, here we are, friends. Our Eccles prize for sending in the first correct answer to the Radio Times crossword puzzle. David Dunhill himself.
How do you do?
This is Mr. Crocker.
Do.
Mrs. Winston Liz.
How do.
Mr. and Mrs. Oldcliffe.
How do.
Mrs. Grant. Grant! Oh. This is David Dunhill from the Wireless. Oh, look at her smiling and nodding. She thinks it's supper time, silly old fool.
Dunhill, Jackson's my name.
How do you do, Jack?
How do you do? Jack, out to me, friends. This is my eldest girl, Loretta. Stop chewing your beads, Loretta. Go on. Ask him what you want to ask him.
Well, what is it, Loretta?
Oh, no, she's gone shy. Yeah, she wanted you to say, this is the light program and general overseas service of the BBC.
Oh, well, yes, I like it.
But quiet, everybody. Quiet. Belt up for Dave. The floor's yours, Dave.
Go on, Dave, boy.
Well, go on. This is the light program and general overseas service of the BBC.
Very good, Dave. There, Loretta. There.
Loretta, if you don't stop that, you'll stay like it.
Isn't it marvellous she's in a world of her own, you know?
Dave, tell me, one thing I've always wondered. When you read the 1 o'clock news,
mm-hmm.
Do you have your lunch before or after? Or do you have sandwiches during?
Generally, I have it before.
Go on.
See, otherwise, by the time I get to the canteen, the main dish is off.
Oh, you have a canteen then? Fancy. I don't know, somehow I never thought of announcers as eating.
Dave, on that point, something occurs to me. If you have to bolt your lunch before
uh-huh.
and then read off all that muck directly after a heavy meal, do you ever get, bit of a comeback? The return of the sausage, as it was?
Oh, Les, what a question. We're not all like you.
Well, these things have got to be fate. It's only nature, isn't it? Well,
of course, if such a thing did happen, we should simply apologize. And we'd say, I beg your pardon.
Well, that's something that never occurred to me. Well... I can see we're going to learn a lot from you over this week, Dave.
How about having the 9 o'clock news on, Les? Get the weather.
Well, we'll have the news. Well, wait a minute. Why have the wireless news on when we got our own announcer here?
Yeah,
go on, Dave. Give us the 9 o'clock news. Go on, then.
But I don't know the 9 o'clock news.
Well, I'll read a bit from the evening paper. Yeah.
Quiet for Dave.
Go on, Dave.
Dave, Dave. Dave, I want to speak up a bit so Gran can hear. Here. Read this bit here. This one. Yes.
I have worn the new pencil fashion skirt, and although it may be a success in Paris, I cannot see it catching on with British women. Although...
Well, that was a week to remember, wasn't it, eh? He was a real nice lad, that Dunhill, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He ate with us, he went out with us, he kept grand company.
He's on tonight, you know, he said. Oh, let's hear him. It's different when somebody's been one of the family for 7 whole days. Switch on, Les.
Right.
This is the BBC Home Service. Saturday Night Theatre presents Edda Gabler by Hibson.
What you said. Tell me about the birds and bees. How do you make a chicken sneeze? Tell and then I'll go to bed.
Oh, worry, worry, weary end my day. Comes the time to go home without my raising pay. Home by the fire where a man can just relax. Slippers there by the chair, not a worry nor a care. Along comes Junior, swinging his little axe.
Uncle Timmy, tell me a story.
Shut up!
Tell me a story.
Shut up!
Tell me a story. Remember what you said.
Oh, dear.
Tell me how your eye got black because the doorway hit your back. Tell me a story, and then I'll go to bed.
All right. Once upon a time, I remember long ago.
Oh, now don't go back in history. Your memory's kind of slow.
Stop your noisy talking till I finish with my tale. Once upon a...
Upon a what?
Upon your back, you'll get a swat.
Tell me about the fish you caught that's bigger than a whale.
Oh, I haven't said.
Tell me a story. Tell me a story. Tell me a story. Remember what you said.
Yes.
You promised me you said you would. You've got to give in, so I'll be good.
Here's a tale you won't forget. And now get up to bed.
Oh, gee, tell me another story, Uncle Timmy.
All right, I'll tell you the story about a horrid little boy who kept pestering his uncle until he shot him.
No. Remember what you said.
Oh, dear.
Tell me how your eye got black because the doorway hit your back. Tell me a story and then I'll go to bed.
All right. Once upon a time, I remember long ago.
Oh, now don't go back in history. Your memory's kind of slow.
Stop your noisy talking till I finish with my tale. Once upon a...
Upon a what?
Upon your back, you'll get a swat.
Tell me about the fish you caught that's bigger than a whale.
Oh, I haven't said.
Tell me a story. Tell me a story. Tell me a story. Remember what you said.
Yes.
You promised me you said you would. You gotta give in, so I'll be good.
Here's a tale you won't forget.
My tail's all red.
And now get up to bed.
Oh, gee, tell me another story, Uncle Timmy.
All right, I'll tell you the story about a horrid little boy who kept pestering his uncle until he shot him.
No.
So we come to the TIFF Film Award, the TIFF Oscar. And this week it's the... Don't you realize that the Earth is being invaded by hostile creatures from another planet, all of them armed with strange, deadly weapons against which mankind has no defense, so that the whole of our world is in danger of being enslaved by these alien monsters from outer space? Type of tripe.
Yes, it's Hollywood's newest plot. We've had several recent films showing us what is likely to happen if invaders from Mars land their spaceships on American soil.
Our Tosca-winning film shows what would happen if Martians had the infernal impudence to land on British soil. Ladies and gentlemen, we present Of Martian Men, or Here's a Thing. April the 15th, 1964, it happened. From the black night sky, there was a rush, a whoosh, a screaming blaze of light, and a great saucer-shaped object hurled itself into the peaceful earth of a Stoke Newington back garden.
A moment of silence. Then from inside came a scrabbling noise. A hatch lifted and something snaked out. A scaly, groping tentacle with claws and a great hairy...
Wait a minute, Wallace. Bentley, come out of that cupboard. It's only a story.
The Martians had arrived.
The first intimation the government had was the report from Albert Clamp, the Stoke Newington man in whose back garden the spaceship fell. The following morning, he arrived at the office of the Home Secretary, Sir Smedley Blatherley.
And just finished the letter by saying that as regards the damage to the statue in Trafalgar Square, I'm afraid that's not my pigeon. then finish yours affect the onset. Oh, dear, the phone again. I won't keep you a moment, Mr. Clamp. Hello, Blathering here. Oh, it's you, Winnie. Mm. Yes, another late due last night, what, eh? Eh? You lost your garter? Well, I haven't got it. Goodbye.
Was that the Prime Minister?
No, it was one of the girls in the typing pool, you know. Man's not made of wood. No, Mr. Clamp, you wanted to see me.
Oh, sir, it's awful, sir, it's awful, sir. There is a thing at the bottom of my garden.
Well, my dear fellow, lots of old houses are built like that.
No, sir. I don't mean the potting shed.
Oh, pardon me.
Sir, I know you'll say I'm off me nut, but, sir, a spaceship from another planet has landed on my rhubarb.
The deuce it has.
Last night, sir, my wife Ada saw it come down, sir.
Did she?
Yes, she went out to try and chuck it over into the garden next door. We don't get on very well with the people next door. He's a Major Prendergast, sir,
yes,
the Indian Army. Very toppy nose.
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Many's the time I've said to him, look here, Major, you can't talk to me like that. I was your number one boy.
Yes. Get on about the weird, unearthly monster.
Well, I told you, sir, Ada went out to have a deco. Then from the spaceship, a sort of tentacle came out, pointed a kind of tube at her. There was a flash. And my Ada, she was just a little pile of grey dust. I don't know what to make of it, sir.
Well, how about an egg timer?
Oh, sir, there are dozens of monsters on the spaceship, sir.
Oh.
What are they, sir? What are they?
Keep a cool head. Keep a cool head. Don't clamp, my dear Panic. I'll send for the Home Office biologist. Ask Miss Caldicott to come up. She's a very clever woman, this Miss Caldicott. A blue stocking, you know.
A blue stocking?
Yes, she keeps her fountain pen clipped to her nylons.
You sent for me, Mr. Smedley?
Oh, yes. Now, what was it I wanted you for?
The Martian's landing.
You're getting hysterical, Mr. Clamp. I have to advise you, Miss Caldicott, that incredible though it may seem, the ultimate catastrophe is upon us.
The auditors have arrived.
The Martians, miss. Unearthly creatures, all scaly and horrible. Horrible, miss. Horrible!
Oh, control yourself, man. Sir Smedley, give me the salient facts in terms that a scientist can assimilate.
Well, I see. They've turned his wife into an egg timer and ruined his rhubarb.
Oh, I'm sorry I rounded on you, Clamp. It must have been a pretty grievous blow.
I can't believe it. How can I keep going without Miss Stewart Rhubarb?
But you've lost your wife.
Well, it's nice of you to try and cheer me up, miss. All I want is to see these creatures destroyed. Destroy them before they destroy us.
Sir Smedley, I have just come from analyzing the Martian invaders, and I have discovered they are an oxygen-breathing form of organic life.
Oh, no, they're half awful.
Yes. Physically, they're 18 feet tall, and their eyes wave above the top of their heads on stalks.
By Jiminy, they're absolutely built for coronation watching.
They have completely annihilated Stoke Newington and are advancing on Dalston Junction, wiping out everything in their path.
Sir Smedley, you must mobilize the army.
Send out jet bombers.
Warn the world.
But it's 5-5. Can't it wait till the morning?
Sir Smedley, the world must know now.
This is the Light Program and Overseas Service of the BBC. Here is an announcement of vital urgency. Our country is being invaded by the planet of Mars. All listeners are warned to stand by their radio sets, and the BBC will issue communiques at 15-minute intervals. Meanwhile, here is a record of Charlie Coons playing a medley from White Horse Inn. For just a moment, we interrupt the record to give you another report. At this moment, a hushed House of Commons is listening anxiously to the Home Secretary, Sir Smedley Blathery.
The hooks in the cloakroom have definitely been swiped by somebody. Audibly. And now, Mr. Speaker, I come to the grave matter about which the whole world is deeply concerned, and which the members of this House have quite likely...
Wait a minute. Whoa, back. I've broken the lead of my pencil. Rattling on there. Give us a chance to sharpen it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hansard. Now... Mr. Speaker, I have been in conference with my expert advisors all afternoon.
What about the Martians?
I'm coming to that. If the honorable member would stop ogling Miss Pat Hornby Smith and pay attention for a bit, maybe we'd get on a bit faster. Mr. Speaker, I have brought to the House Mr. Albert Clamp himself.
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is that I never had a fair chance. Once them coppers get their knife into you...
Clamp!
The Clamp!
Clamp! Are you talking about this isn't a court? Perhaps Miss Caldicott had better tell the House the whole situation.
The situation is that the Martians are invincible.
It's quite true.
They have this ray, a ray which induces a feeling of complete numbness.
But what sort of ray is it that induces complete numbness?
Don't worry, Ted, we've resisted the temptation. But, Mildred, Miss Caldicott, how can we hit back at them?
We have no way of hitting back. We're powerless against them. All we can do is surrender.
Surrender? You ask Britain to give in? Never. Mr. Speaker, honorable members, I think I'm conveying the spirit of the House when I say that this is ridiculous. Is this the spirit of Drake? Drake, the finest centre-forward Arsenal ever had? Surely there must be something that can kill the Martians and Martianesses.
I've got the answer. I alone can save the world.
Who said that?
Me, Albert Clamp.
Oh, thank heavens, I thought it was Renarum Bevan. You have the answer?
Mr. Smed, I've been having a big think.
You have?
I have. The only dead Martians are the ones that landed in my garden. And I think I know why. The Martians are susceptible to rhubarb.
The Martians?
By jingo! By jingo, it could be. It is possible for certain organic chemicals to affect their Martian metabolism. Yes. With rhubarb, you get hyperphosphate alkali and vituated potash.
Really? I get custard with mine. Mr. Speaker, honorable members, you realize what this means? Rhubarb is the way to save the world.
Now the scientists sprang into action. The finest brains in England blueprinted the rhubarb bomb. Sir John Cockcroft, Frank Whittle, Dr. Penny, with the technical assistance of Philip Harbin.
The situation was now desperate. New York had gone down magnificently. The south of France was overrun. The Bahamas were lost. It began to look as though the dockers would have to spend their next holiday at Westcott.
Then word came that the rhubarb bomb was ready. It was a very grave Home Secretary who took his place in the observation trench facing the oncoming Martians.
I'm sorry I'm late. I had to wash my shirt. I'm on in the news on Friday. Now, this is it, isn't it? All set, Dr. Caldicott?
All set. In that bomb, there are 400 tons of concentrated stewed rhubarb.
Without sugar.
Ooh. Makes me tingle all funny.
The destruction will take place in exactly 3 minutes.
But how will we know when that is? We haven't got a watch.
Don't worry. I've brought me egg timer.
Well, hurry up. They're advancing towards us.
Right. I'll give Ada a bit of a tap. Now. That's it. Now.
It's worked! Look at them reeling and staggering!
No, don't get out of the trench. The whole area is still rhubarb active.
Look, they're taking to their spaceship. They're flying away.
We've won! The world is saved thanks to you, Mildred.
Mildred!
I'm talking to him. Thanks to your ingenuity, the Martians have gone. All that remains of their stay here are those strange ray guns with which they've reduced so many of us to little heaps of dust.
I reckon we should keep them ray guns as souvenirs of the greatest peril the world has ever known.
I absolutely concur.
Well concurred. I, in that case, you too shall have this one to keep for yourselves.
Oh, Charlie, very nice.
Take it, but do be careful not to press this little knob where my finger is resting, because the slightest pressure will release it. Oh, somebody fetch the vacuum cleaner.
And the augmented BBC Variety Orchestra bring our recorded show to a close. Those involved were Joy Nichols, Dick Bentley and Professor Jimmy Edwards, encouraged by Wallace Eaton, Herbert Mostyn and the keynotes. Frank Muir and Dennis Norton wrote the script, and the program was produced by Charles Maxwell. Joy, Dick and Jimmy invite you to
take it from me.
Did you enjoy today's edition of Showcase? Would you like us to broadcast one of these variety programs each week? Or would you prefer listening to another one of England's top-rated shows? Let us know, as we are most anxious to receive your comments. Your letters may determine the type of program we will present in a full series after our initial 13-week broadcast of Showcase. So write to Showcase, NBC, New York 20, New York, and let us know whether or not you would like to hear a series of variety programs such as we offered on today's broadcast. Next week at this time, Showcase will bring you a true story of a famous trial at Old Bailey in 1911, Prisoner at the Bar. This is Gene Hamilton. We'll be expecting you next Saturday for Showcase.
Top French talent is featured in Spotlight on Paris tonight on the NBC Radio Network.
From April 24th, 1954 on NBC, an episode of Showcase, a series of test programs determining if there was a demand for British radio programming on American airwaves. This particular broadcast featuring a sample of the variety show Take It From Here. One thing that the NBC audience probably picked up on right away with these programs is that with the BBC, there were no commercials, the Europeans having been far ahead of the Americans in the development of commercial-free public service broadcasting. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch with the Radio Theater, our email address is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And if you want more info about the show, including detailed program playlists, or if you want to listen to this and previous episodes of the Radio Theater at your convenience, then please visit our blog and website at qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. If you want the playlist or audio for this episode, look for Upstate Radio Theater program number 1806. We'll wrap up the hour with an episode of Obsession. This was one of many programs developed after World War II in the mid and late 40s and early 50s, focusing on the macabre, the strange, the terrifying. Such programming was at a minimum during the war for obvious reasons. Obsession was independently produced by C.P. McGregor and debuted in 1950 as a filler program on WBBM in Chicago. It was awarded its own time slot on WBBM starting in 1951. The series was picked up by other stations as a syndicated broadcast, including the Armed Forces Radio Service. And we have an Armed Forces Radio re-airing of an episode of Obsession. No specific date on this episode, probably originally airing sometime in 1951. It stars Joan Loring. It's called Surrender is Farewell.
In all the octaves of human emotion, no one is more fraught with peril, more like the deceptive chameleon than that which we know as love. For love and hate are kindred things, each bound by the tensile strength of a silken cord that slowly but inevitably strangles those caught in the web of obsession. And so the story of Surrender is Farewell, starring Joan Loring. Central Station, and the huge waiting room is silent and empty. Empty, that is, except for a small figure huddled in a far corner. There, a young girl, her pretty face streaked with tears, sits writing a letter of surrender and farewell, in which she pours out a pitiful story of three lives made untenable by the irresistible powers of one mind, filled to overbrimming with the slow poisons of an insanely jealous obsession.
Dear Linda, in 30 minutes I shall be on my way back to Indiana. It is hard to realize that it's been only 2 months since that day I saw New York for the first time. The day when Roger and I drove north out of the city to his home in the rolling Connecticut countryside. We were so happy, with no premonitions of what lay ahead.
Just around the next bend, you'll be able to see it, Carol. Your new home.
Our new home, darling. Oh, Roger, I'm so happy.
When I left here last month on that business trip, I never thought I'd be returning with a wife. Particularly such a pretty one.
Are you sorry?
What do you think? Hey, there, you can sit over there, over on that little hill.
Oh, Roger, it's beautiful.
You like it?
I'm overwhelmed, darling. I never dreamed that someday I'd have a home like that.
For the woman I love, nothing is too good.
You're all I really want, Roger.
Hey, here's the drive. Won't be long now.
Oh, I've never seen such trees. And that lawn.
Linda's probably watching us out of the front window, just dying to get a glimpse of her new sister-in-law.
What's she like, Roger?
Oh, she's considerably older than I am. Ever since my parents died 20 years ago, she's been more like a mother than a sister.
I'll bet she's sweet.
Well, you have to know Linda to appreciate it. She has a few funny ideas.
Roger, I just know we'll get along.
Oh, sure. Well, this is it. Cameron domicile. Shall we go in?
We will. After you kiss me.
Oh, Carol, darling.
One's enough, Mr. Cameron. Come on, let's go in.
You killed Joy? Here comes Linda now. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Roger, dear. I received your wire.
Bet you were surprised to learn the big news, huh?
That would be an understatement. This, I presume, is Carol.
Hello, Linda.
Isn't she just the way I described her, Linda?
Let's say she's exactly what I expected. Shall we go in?
Linda, you can't possibly know how excited I am about all this.
You would do well, my dear, to restrain some of that exuberance. I considered your exhibition in front of the house just now most improper.
But, Linda, I only kissed her.
I'm not blaming you, Roger. Hereafter, Carol, remember that you're a Cameron and conduct yourself accordingly.
Well, I'm sorry if I...
We won't discuss it further. The door, please, Roger.
Well, not a thing has changed since I left.
Of course not. We shall eat in exactly 25 minutes, Carol. I assume you'd like to change your clothes.
Well, I think if I just wash up a bit, I'll
It's all very well to wear one's oldest suit while traveling, but I think it's hardly suitable for dinner.
But I... Yes, Linda.
I'll expect you for dinner at 6 o'clock sharp.
Oh, Roger, she doesn't like me.
Oh, nonsense, darling. She doesn't even know you yet.
One's oldest suit, she said. Roger, this is the newest and most expensive piece of clothing I own.
Oh, we'll remedy that, honey. Tomorrow, I'll turn you loose in the city and let you buy the finest wardrobe money can buy. And, don't you worry about Linda.
But I did worry about you, Linda. I couldn't disregard the smoldering animosity in your eyes. The edge of resentment in the tone of your voice. I tried at first to tell myself that I was merely imagining things, but the next morning after Roger had left for his office...
Well, Carol, are you satisfied with your new home?
I'm in love with it. And I have the most marvelous idea for new curtains in the dining room.
New curtains?
Mm-hmm. I thought yellow would be nice, to replace those rather drab maroon ones.
I selected those maroon curtains, Carol. I furnished this house from carpets to kitchenware. And nothing will be changed.
But, Linda, I am Roger's wife now.
We may as well get one thing straight at the outset, Carol. I've been running this house for Roger for 20 years, and I don't intend to stop now.
All right, Linda. We won't argue about it today.
Nor any other day. I thought you were going shopping.
I am. I was just about to get ready.
Tell me, how much money did Roger give you this morning?
Now, really, I don't think that that's any... I mean...
You don't think it's any of my business. Is that what you were going to say?
Well, I didn't intend to be that abrupt. I'm sorry.
Carol, Roger worked hard for his money. And I'm not going to stand by and see him squander it because he happens to be temporarily blinded by his emotions.
Are you calling our marriage a blinding of emotions, Linda?
Is, this your purse here on the table?
Linda, you have no right to do that.
Let's see. $50. Well, that's not unreasonable.
$50? But Roger gave me $250.
I wouldn't lie to you, Carol. Here, you can see for yourself.
Yes. That's strange. I put the money in there just 30 minutes ago, and you were the only one in the room.
Are you implying that I stole money from your purse?
Oh, no, Linda, I didn't mean that.
That's precisely what you meant. You were accusing me.
Believe me, Linda, you misinterpret what I said.
You can be sure that Roger will hear of this when he comes home tonight. And you can also be sure that he won't be pleased to learn that his sister was called a thief in her own home.
confused and unhappy. Linda, I wanted so desperately to please you, but it seemed that I was meeting your disfavor at every turn. I left the house and purposely stayed away until late afternoon so that we wouldn't be left alone together. But when I arrived home, Roger still hadn't returned.
Is that you, Carol?
Yes, Linda.
You're a little late, dear.
I'm sorry, I lost track of the time.
Well, we'll have to hurry to have dinner ready by the time Roger arrives.
All right, Linda, I'll start dinner now.
Before you leave, Carol, there's something I'd like to show you.
Yes?
Over there on the mantel. It's Roger's most prized possession.
You mean that vase? He never told me about it.
It was made in Tibet over 1,000 years ago.
Oh.
It's been in the family for 5 generations.
It's beautiful. I can understand why Roger values it.
You can't see it from there. I'll get it for you. Here.
Oh, it's lovely.
You take it.
Linda, it's just lovely. Oh, you dropped it. Linda, you deliberately pushed it from my hand.
I beg your pardon. I handed it to you and you let it slip from your fingers.
Linda, what should we do?
Well, don't implicate me in this. You're the one who dropped it.
How can I ever face Roger with...
You'd better have a good story.
I'll have to confess that I did it.
Don't be a fool. It'll be far better if Roger never knew what happened.
But I couldn't lie to him.
If you value your marriage, you'll do as I say. You can let him think that it was stolen. Yes, that's it.
No, Linda, I can't.
You must. Here, I'll help pick up the pieces.
I just don't know what to do.
Not in the wastebasket, Carol. You'll see them in there.
But, Linda,
Put the pieces in the pockets of your suit. Like this. You can dispose of them later.
Please, this isn't right.
Hurry, you'll be home in a minute.
Hello there. What are you two up to?
Roger.
Carol. The vase.
She dropped it, Roger. I told her it was valuable, but...
Oh, darling, I'm so
Carol,
sorry.
Carol, weren't you putting the broken pieces in your pockets?
Please, Roger, I can explain to you.
She was trying to escape blame, Roger. She thought if she hid the evidence that you'd think it was stolen.
No, I can't believe it. Is that true, Carol?
No, Roger. I mean... Oh, darling,
What about it, Linda?
You can see for yourself what she was doing. That should be proof.
Roger, listen to me.
I'd rather not talk about it now, Carol. I can only say that I never thought you'd try to deceive me like this.
It would have been a clever ruse, but it just didn't work.
Please, Linda.
I think you should also know, Roger, that she lost $200 of that money you gave her, and then accused me of stealing it.
Accused you? Carol, what's happened to you?
It was just a misunderstanding, Roger. This has all been a misunderstanding.
Excuse me. I won't be down for dinner.
Roger, please wait.
Too late now, Carol.
Oh, Linda, how could you do it?
How could I do what?
You intentionally created that situation. Why? Why do you dislike me so? All I want is an opportunity to make Roger happy.
Happy? What do you know about the kind of life Roger should have? Everything Roger is today, he owes to me. And everything he will be shall be the result of my guidance. My guidance, Carol.
But I'm not standing in his way.
Don't interrupt me. He married you under the stress of an emotion he naively calls love.
But why are you so opposed to me?
What possible good can you ever do him? You have no money, no connections, no standing. Why, you don't even know the fundamentals of our kind of life.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to smash you, Carol. And when I get through, you'll regret the day that you had the audacity to enter his life.
All right, Linda. But there's something you should realize first. I'm going to fight back, Linda. I love Roger, and I'm going to fight with everything I have to hold him.
Story of obsession, Surrender is Farewell, starring Joan Loring. The most lethal of organic poisons has an antidote, but not so the slow-acting poison of the mind, compounded from suspicion, doubt, mistrust, jealousy, fear. Roger suffers from that subtle poison. And all the love and trust within the power of Carol is insufficient to neutralize its devastating progress. For this elixir of hate is compounded in the inscrutable privacy of a woman's mind. In the waiting room of Grand Central Station, Carol forces herself to continue the letter, the personal account of a woman's struggle for happiness in the face of a wild and unreasoning obsession.
I should have known better than to try to fight you, Linda. I didn't have your weapons. I'd never learned your tactics. Your control over Roger's life had its roots in years of dominance. My power only lay in my love. And so the days slid into weeks, and everyone brought with it new humiliations. I remember one evening 2 weeks ago.
Roger. Roger?
Yes, what is it, Linda?
You'll be happy to know that I found those gray suede shoes of mine I was looking for this morning.
Well, that's fine, Linda. I'm glad to hear it.
And I found them in Carol's closet. Can you imagine it? Perhaps Carol can explain.
I can't stand it any longer. I can't go on like this.
Carol, I don't understand.
Just leave me alone. Leave me alone.
But I can't help you if you don't tell me what's wrong.
There's nothing wrong with her, Roger. She's merely clamoring for attention.
No. No, Roger.
I don't know what to do, Linda. She's changed so much during these past weeks.
I was wondering when you'd finally see her for what she is.
Oh, stop it. Stop it, stop it.
Please, Carol.
And you ask me what's wrong. Are you completely blind, Roger?
Don't listen to her.
Believe me, I've tried to be a good wife. But what's the good of trying when she's living here?
Carol, what are you saying?
I'm saying that Linda's the one behind this. Yes, Roger, your precious sister, Linda.
Linda?
She's deliberately set out to break up our marriage with her lies and implications and tricks.
Roger, are you going to permit her to talk about your own sister like that?
But it's true. And you can't deny it, Linda.
But she's my sister, Carol.
Yes, and I'm your wife. That is, if you can call this state of existence a marriage.
I refuse to listen to any more. Are you coming, Roger?
You go on up, Linda. I want to talk with Carol.
Very well. Good night, Roger.
Oh, Roger, can't we get away from here? Can't we start out all over again?
But, Carol, my business is here. And I can't walk out on Linda after all she's done for me.
All right, then. If you won't walk out on Linda, I will.
You can't mean that.
What's the use of pretending?
I don't know what to say. I've been so confused.
Maybe she was right. Maybe I am ruining your life.
So confused. My head aches so...
Roger, you're ill.
No, I'm all right.
Let me feel your forehead.
I'm just tired, that's all.
Roger, you're burning up with fever.
I have the strangest feeling like...
Roger! Oh, darling!
Carol, what have you done to him?
He fainted. We must get a doctor.
This is your fault, Carol. If you...
Never mind that now, Linda. Can't you see he needs help?
He's resting quietly now.
Is it serious, Doctor?
Well, it could very easily turn into pneumonia. He's apparently been under some great strain because his resistance is abnormally low.
Well, you can be sure, Doctor, that he'll get the very best care here.
I'll leave these pills with you, Mrs. Cameron.
But one moment, Doctor. I'll take those.
But, well, all right. You'll have to watch him closely. If his temperature goes any higher, call me.
We can take shifts, Doctor, so that one of us will be with him at all times.
Is there anything else, Doctor?
No, that's all. I'll stop by in the morning. Good night.
Good night.
Well... Are you satisfied, Carol? I hold you responsible for this. I want you to stay away from Roger while I nurse him back to health.
You can't ask me to do that. Roger needs me.
Oh, stop deluding yourself.
I've tolerated a lot from you, Linda. I've taken your sarcasm and your humiliations and your cheap tricks. But I will not let you keep me away from Roger at a time like this.
You'll do as I say, Carol.
We'll see. I'm going into him now, and you can't...
I'll slap you again if you persist in disobeying me. Good night.
During the next 2 days, you never left Roger's bedside, blocking me whenever I tried to see him. For the first time, I began to doubt myself. Was it true that Roger no longer needed me?
On the third evening, we had our first hope that he might recover. It was a black, stormy night, and you were just starting up the stairs to Roger's room. Carol, hurry.
Linda, what is it?
I don't know. I thought for a moment I was going to faint.
It's no wonder you haven't slept for two nights.
Pain. Cuts right across my eyes.
Linda, you've worked until you're ill. I'm going to put you to bed.
No. No, I must go to Roger.
Don't worry about that now. Here, I'll take you to your room, and then I'll call the doctor.
I'm so tired.
Come on. Just a few more steps, and we'll be at the top.
I'll be back in a minute. Please.
There. Just lean against me.
I'm so weak. Oh, Roger. There's medicine.
I'll take care of that. You're going to your room.
Yes, yes. You take care of it, Carol.
Here we are now. Now try to stand while I open the door. There. Come on, over to the bed now.
Yes. I want to sleep.
You're going to be all right, Linda. Just lie there while I call the doctor. Hello, operator. Operator. Oh. Linda, the storm must have blown the lines down. I'm going out to get him.
But you can't drive.
I'll walk. It's 2 miles. I ran down the stairs, put on my coat, and started out the door. Then I realized I was the only one. The only one who could help you. No one would ever blame me if I didn't go out on a night like that. It was my one chance to get you out of my life. My one chance for a happy marriage with Roger. Why should I sacrifice my whole future for a person who'd given me nothing but pain? I hesitated a moment longer. And then I made my decision.
She's going to be all right, Mrs. Cameron. But if you hadn't come for me when you did, she might not have lasted until morning.
Yes, Doctor, I know.
You'd better get to bed yourself, young lady. Running around in that storm couldn't have done you any good.
No, I'm all right. How is Roger?
Completely out of danger. Should be up and around in a few days.
I'm so grateful.
Well, I'll be running along. I hope your sister-in-law realizes she owes her life to what you did tonight.
I should have known, Linda, that nothing could ever straighten out that strange warp in your mind. But I did hope. I hoped and prayed that things would be different. Only to have those hopes smashed when I overheard you and Roger talking this afternoon.
But you can't be serious about this, Linda, not after what's happened.
We shouldn't have waited this long. If you weren't such an idealist, you'd understand.
Well, I don't understand. I don't understand why the two of you can't live together in the same house.
You know how it's been these past 2 months since Carol arrived. I tell you, the situation is impossible.
But it's not fair of you to expect me to treat someone I love in that fashion.
My mind's made up. Do you want me to tell Carol?
I don't know what she'll think.
That makes no difference. This is for your own good, Roger.
I turned away then and walked slowly to my room. I left very calmly and quietly. So quietly that even as I write this, you probably don't know I've gone. Yes, I've given up the fight, Linda. And my surrender is farewell. Oh, Roger. Roger, darling.
Hello, Carol.
Roger. What are you doing here?
When I discovered your clothes gone, I figured you'd be here at the station. Well, come home with me, Carol, please.
No, Roger, I can never go back.
But why, Carol? Why are you running away?
It'll always be the same in that house, Roger. Once I'd hoped that Linda could change, but then I heard the two of you talking this afternoon.
Well, I was going to tell you.
You don't have to now.
I still can't understand why you feel that you must leave just because Linda's leaving.
Because Linda's leaving?
But I thought that...
Well, it seems that Linda's done a lot of thinking since the night of her collapse, and now she has the idea it'd be better for us if she left.
Oh, Roger, I can't believe it.
Well, naturally, I was upset. She's my sister, and I do love her. But she said her mind was made up.
Oh, Roger.
Will you come home with me, Carol, please?
Oh, yes, darling, I will. I will.
Linda wanted to see you before she left.
Maybe I misjudged Linda. Maybe we could be friends.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I'm sorry, darling.
I'll take your bags. Say, what have you been writing there?
Nothing, Roger. Nothing at all.
You have been listening to Obsession.
Obsession has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Obsession, program number 17 in that syndicated series, Surrender is Farewell, originally broadcast domestically at some point in 1951, re-aired by the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service much later than 1951, I'm guessing, because the Armed Forces Radio Service, AFRS, did not become the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service, AFRTS, until 1954. And with that, we come to the end of this hour of the program. My name is Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for your company. I hope you enjoyed my selections. Please join me again soon for another hour of sounds from radio's golden age. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.